the UCR Podcast.
Okay, so here is part two of this week's podcast, which is a big Satch Vi extravaganza. Part one, if you missed it, it is being posted simultaneously today and features a conversation with Steve Vi. Now, here's the other half of that Satch Vi collective, a chat with Joe Satriani, who always has a ton of interesting thoughts to share on a number of different subjects. I caught up with Joe as he was in the midst of the latest Las Vegas residency with Sammy Hagar and Michael Anthony, and we talk about everything that's been going on with that in the past couple of years, as Sammy has done the Best of All Worlds tribute to Van Halen. And then, of course, we dig deep into his current Satch Vi band with Steve Vi. The pair are on the road as we speak, playing shows with bassist Marco Mendoza and drummer extraordinaire Kenny Aronoff. As we did with Steve, we spoke about the Satch Vi album that's been in the works, and we also got Joe's thoughts on where he might be headed next creatively, and Joe also gives us an update on the upcoming G3 documentary. It is Matt Wardlaw. If this is your first time hearing the UCR podcast, smash that subscribe button so that you will get new episodes as we release them, and tell 10 friends about it. Visit Joe's website at satriani.com for the latest, greatest on all things Joe. And for God's sake, go see Satch Vi. You'll be so glad that you did. Here's our conversation with Joe Satriani. Enjoy. These Vegas shows, man, they seem like they've been a lot of fun so far.
They are. Oh, man, they are. I mean, number one, Sammy and Mike and Kenny and our new guy, Greg Fillinghades, they're just really great people. They're fun to play with. It's wonderful to share the stage with them. Sam and Mike are just, they're just so cool. I mean, when they hit the stage, they really know how to lift people up. That's really a great thing to see. And they do it differently every night, which is really enriching, you know, and they surprise you with how good they are at doing that, you know, making each night memorable for everybody in the audience. And then you've got these hit songs. I mean, if you can put together, you know, 20 hit songs, that's like, wow. It's like every time you start a song, people go crazy. You're like, wow, that's really good. All you have to do is make sure you play it right. Don't forget your parts, you know. And but that's a very important thing. After being a musician in cover bands and original bands, that's what you always hope for, is that when you start a song, it's recognized, you know, by everybody in the audience.
So you and Kenny, between Chickenfoot, I guess that's 2.0, 3.0, whatever it was when Kenny came in, but you and Kenny have a lot of miles, you know, playing with Sammy and Michael. Between that and, of course, what you guys have been doing with this Best of All Worlds band, what do you think it is, man, now that you've gotten kind of under the hood with Sammy Hagar and Michael Anthony in the way that you guys have? What is it about the mojo that those two guys, Sammy and Michael, have? What do you think it is?
Wow. I think, part of it you can't put into words, you know, when Sam and Mike start working together, because they don't repeat themselves. They are unique and different from each other in remarkable ways. And the sound of their voice is so different. You know, Mike has got this purity voice that I should warn you, never stand in front of him when he screams. It's like a, you know, like a chrome rod through your brain. It's so loud and so pure, you know. And Sam's voice is just this really huge thing. It's just really, it's hard to explain how big it is. I learned that when the first time we did, he and I sat down in the studio to write some songs for Chickenfoot. And with just two guys sitting on some folding chairs with a guitar, and he starts to sing quietly. And I was like shocked, like how big his voice was, just sitting there on a chair singing, you know, to Sexy Little Thing or something like that. I was like, wow, all you have to do is like put the right microphone in front of this guy. Like, no wonder people love to hear his voice singing. It's just remarkable. They both push each other and themselves to be as excellent as possible. They're very conscious of making sure that everybody in the audience has a great time. They're really good at allowing each band member to be themselves, which is important. It's not like they have this rigid expectation of everybody. It's really interesting. And then you, after you get past all that amazing stuff, the original stuff, one of the things that makes it really a lot of fun as a musician is you discovering what they're, the building blocks of their style is, and what they are, their influences. I think that's the one thing that really helped Chickenfoot is when we got together, we weren't sure what we were going to do. We knew that there was pressure to be like a combination of Van Halen and the Chili Peppers, you know, but I remember that first day we played in the studio, we said, you know what, we're not going to sound like Van Halen or Chili Peppers or Surfing with the Alien. We should bounce off of each other based on our early influences and what our building blocks are, you know. And that became the classic rock. That's what we all shared. And I always thought that Sam was kind of a soul singer. That was like where he started out. And what he really relates to, which is like different from David Lee Roth, who every time I heard David Lee Roth sing, I thought this guy's like a jazz singer who turned himself into this crazy rock and roll, you know, lead singer. But he actually, you know, rhythmically and stylistically, he sings like a jazz singer. And Sammy's the total opposite. He sings like a soul singer, you know, and once you learn that, it's like you're able to decode your band member, and it makes it so much easier to follow them and to support them, you know, when they're improvising on stage.
You guys have not done a ton over the Vegas run, if we look at the last, you know, round of Vegas dates, but it had to be kind of a trip for you, knowing the Van Halen catalog like you do, to stand there with Michael Anthony on the same stage playing a song like Running with the Devil, man. Like that, yes. To get that moment is pretty cool.
It is. It's still a pinch me moment, you know? And because I am still a Van Halen fan throughout all their eras, you know, I went to see them in concert. I've always thought Eddie was like one of the saviors of the electric guitar. And just when we needed Edward Van Halen, he came along and blew our minds, you know? So I was always like cheering him on, like, you're the one, keep doing it. it makes me feel good. And, but it scares the shit out of me as well, because I don't really play like him. There are a lot of things that he does. He was able to do so much better than me. And I have to be aware of those things and do little workarounds here and there. He was a very unique guitar player, just, you know, his anatomy, his approach to music, how he grew up playing music, the way that he conceived of timing and harmony was quite unique. He never really sounded methodical. Because like, if you go to like, it's very, you know, if you have like a guitar player or a piano player, let's say, who, you know, you can look at the music and it sounds like something like could have been an exercise, just played really fast and really impressively. It's not that difficult to imitate it, you know, or to reproduce it, as long as you have the physical chops to do it. But good luck if you're trying to replace somebody like Thelonious Monk on keyboard or Jimi Hendrix on guitar, because they never sounded methodical. You know what I mean? They never played anything that sounded like practicing. You know what I mean? It was like pure music. And that's what I responded to the first time seeing Van Halen at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. I was, besides just having a great time, crazy concert, insane. But just looking at Ed play and thinking, this, none of it just sounds like practicing at all. It's just like pure expression. And that's what I've always liked about those early players that were my influences, the foundations, which is Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page, and Jeff Beck, and Pete Townsend, you know, Keith Richards. They played music. They never played exercises, you know.
Eddie was like you, I think. He's very musical. And I talked to Michael Hampton from Funkadelic recently, and he was talking about, I didn't even bring it up, but he busted up the myth that he got the gig with Funkadelic because he could play the solo on Maggot Brain note for note. He said, man, he's like, and I mentioned this because you and Eddie Van Halen, Michael was talking about Eddie Hazel and just how he realized that the deal was that Eddie Hazel was so musical that basically he just went into the studio on Maggot Brain. He played it. And this is not unique, but in this case, they put Maggot Brain together from everything that he played. So Michael was like, the reason that people have a hard time playing Maggot Brain note for note is because Eddie himself really didn't play it note for note. And he's like, and then it made more sense to me why Eddie Hazel would go out on stage and he would play things differently every night. Because you've been there, Joe, like basically Eddie was just on his vibe, on his trip, whatever that trip was on any given night. And I think that Eddie Van Halen, perhaps in the live setting, was a little bit more precise than that, but it's kind of the same basic thing. And I think it must've been interesting for you because as you just kind of laid out, you were right from the moment that it was announced that Sammy and yourself and so on were going to go out and do this Best of All Worlds band. Right from day one, you were on the radio going, man, you were telling people what a big job this was going to be for you. And so how much does it ever become muscle memory? I'm sure that it was a process that didn't start with the first show that you played. I'm sure that it took a while before, at least on a Joe Satriani level, you felt at least comfortable, if that's possible.
Here's the funny thing about that is that there's a timing thing that we as new guys in the band, like specifically Kenny and I, had to try to figure out. Like we were doing a song called Amsterdam, great song, you know, and from a guitar player's point of view, a beautifully complex, like architecture guitar part, just really cool. But the beginning makes absolutely no sense. Like for any band in the world, they would never do that. And so as it usually goes, we go to play the song the first time and Kenny and I look at Mike and Sam, we go, why did you guys do it like this? Like, who counted it in? And then you hear a story that, you know, Eddie and Alex argued with each other about where the one was. And they were stubborn and they wouldn't play to each other's perception of where the one beat was. So, of course, when we hear it as fans, we go, well, where's the one? And the two brothers are trying to fake each other out. And then, you know, the song after the introduction, the song comes down on the downbeat and it's glorious, you know. But when you have to play it, wow, you have to like I have to just think like I am Eddie and I am not Alex. And, you know, Kenny's thinking the same thing, like, I am Alex. I am not listening to Eddie's weird guitar part, you know. And so you have to, like, you know, have this resolve about your part, you know, and in order to get through it. And that's funny like that. I mean, even the simpler song like Panama starts in the most difficult way when it could have been so simple. You know, it could have been 1, 2, 3, 4. Then they started, but they don't. No, when Alex comes in, he comes in on the offbeats and he continues that until finally, you know, Mikey's part comes in. And you ask yourself in those moments, you go, as a band, why did they do that? You know, and why didn't the producer say, can you guys like make that easier? Like, you know, Jamie's crying. That's normal, you know, ain't talking about love. That's normal, you know? And so I just thought that comes up a lot is the funny timing issues with the songs and then asking Mike and Sammy, like, how come? And they tell you the story and you're like, really? Like, that's why it sounds so weird. And it's something to do with brothers, you know?
That's pretty amazing. And I don't think you're going to have a story like that, Joe, but probably there's stuff in your own catalog that has kind of wound up on record in a very interesting way because of, I mean, Def Leppard guys have, of course, all sorts of Mutt Lang type stories, but the circumstance that sometimes drives something to become a certain way in the final version of the song is fascinating. Like, so I'm sure you've got some of that stuff in your catalog where it's just like you have a song that started one place that kind of went to a different place because of whatever the circumstance was.
Oh yeah. Always happens. I think one of the funniest one was, we were doing a Chickenfoot song. I written this song and I had a title for it. It was called Sexy Little Thing. And I sent the demo off to Sam and he really liked it. And we got together to play it. And where he felt the beat was not in the place that I felt the beat was in. And I had written the song and the demo was cut to a click, you know? And I just remember, like, he comes in and I went like, wow, like, that's like genius, you know, the way he just didn't follow the intricacies of the guitar part. He somehow saw the song like more like a big train going down the track. And I'm dealing with the details of each little train car, you know? And, but then the funny thing was, is every time that we would play that song live, Sam would get confused by the way that I played the intro because it starts as on a Celtic upbeat, you know what I mean? And he never heard it that way, you know? And it's one of those things where, In the studio, it was obvious to him and he felt it, but live, it was always like he reverted to his feeling of where the one was. And I had to go with where mine was because I was the one who wrote this lick, you know, and Chad had a good time with us. I tell you, he'd do anything he could to throw it off every time we played live, you know. But that's, you know, the different perception that Sam and I had about where the phrasing was that made the song so much fun to listen to. You know, it's just a weird thing that musicians go through, you know?
That's fantastic. I feel like at one point you told me a story about our arduous process of making a music video. Maybe it was Big Bad Moon, but it seems like perhaps, maybe, this is a big maybe because every time I throw this out to an artist, they say no, but I think maybe you have fun making music videos now with ZZ because the video for Dancing is awesome. So funny.
Great. It's so funny. Well, there's lots of reason for that. You know, I mean, the main reason is that ZZ comes in so prepared, knows exactly what he wants, knows how to communicate to the team. There's a lot of people, you know, behind the camera. And so it always goes really smooth. And I also see him improvising, you know. One of the lighting guys says, you know, it might be better if we move it here because you know, he'll say, go do it, you know? And so like musicians, if a new situation appears and it's better, go with it, you know. Perfect example is after the day after the G3 reunion final concerts, which ZZ filmed and was also playing with us on the last song. We're filming, the video for Sea of Emotion Part One. And they had been there all day filming all the extras and the actors, which were all basically high school friends. And, you know, and we get there and just there's costumes everywhere, old 70s. And ZZ had rented this studio that had separate rooms that all look like the early 70s, you know. And Steve and I are so silly. I mean, we just start putting stuff on, you know. We're not, you know, because they're busy doing stuff, tech stuff, and we're just sitting around and Steve and I are like, oh, doesn't that look funny? Doesn't this look funny? Look at this, Jack. And ZZ comes to look at us and he goes, oh, you guys should keep all that stuff on. I mean, that was a decision that was made so fast. And so there we are. And then, you know, he keeps saying, no, act, you know, be stupider, act silly, you know? But we didn't know because we hadn't seen the whole day of shooting, you know, the story behind, you know, that he had constructed there because we arrived about 8 at night, you know, we worked till about 11 or midnight, but it was so much fun. Everything was really fast and we got to be relaxed. There was none of that tension, you know, And yeah, and even the Cirrus video for I Want to Play My Guitar, I mean, just his idea to in band in the big room at SIR and to have Glenn in the middle, and the way that the cinematic way that he moves around and doesn't always like focus on the person just when they're doing something, because he was keen to the fact that, I mean, you do all these quick cuts, it only holds your interest for about 45 seconds, and then you're like, you know, the audience is like, really, can you tell me where we are and what's going on? So right from the beginning, he has that slow cinematic approach to it. It was just so much fun and so easy, you know. So, and this one, his idea to bring in Brendan was great. And he and Brendan Small had worked on a script. And also, you know, Brendan is a master improviser, great actor and comedian. And so the hard part was not breaking character and just laughing hysterically during all those takes where we were in the fake office, you know, because, you know, we'd be sitting just 2 feet away from Brendan and he'd just be coming up with the funniest things. You know, we had to like compose ourselves. That's really hard if you're not a trained actor, you know. And dancing, of course, being around all those young people dancing like that, that was pretty amazing. I can't remember ever being in a room with people from so many different disciplines of dancing, you know, so many different styles. And everyone was having a good time. Everyone would watch each other. And when they were done with their bit, there'd be all this applause. Everyone was like, wow, that's amazing, you know? And then the next person would come up and do their thing. And it was so much fun. Yeah.
I think that's what's kind of cool about the music that you guys, that you and Steve are doing. You know, I know that dancing is, you know, not an original song, but that was one that, as I was getting ready to talk to Steve within the past couple of weeks, just listening to that song kind of like triggered for me how you guys, I think both collectively and individually, have had this knack for creating these songs that are kind of like little mini movies. So it's kind of appropriate that you are making this music together with Steve at a time where the music video, which at some point somebody kind of declared it dead and they really weren't doing them. And, you know, you just had like a lot of lyric videos or just, you know, videos that were like, let's just shoot the band in the studio and that's the video. Like, to have these videos coming back around now that have storylines, it's kind of fun. And the music you guys are making really kind of lends itself well to that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I'm not really a fan of the playthrough video. That's, you know, that's, it's funny. It's there are things I remember years ago being asked about doing guitar clinics. And I thought, I said, I swear, if I start doing clinics, no one will ever come to see me at a show. They'll just come to the clinic, you know? So I said, why would I do a clinic? I said, that's not my art form. My art form is actually the show. You know, getting on stage, playing the music, and connecting with the audience. That's what I do. I'm not video demonstrator. And social media has, for some reason, excelled at documenting demonstrations. And so I find that incredibly boring. It's useful. Like if you have to learn some Van Halen songs, you find someone who's figured it out. It's like, oh, thank God, I can look at somebody doing it. But it's not the art form that I'm interested in as a performer and a composer. I appreciate it as a, you know, former teacher and someone who's always going to be a student. But it's not something that I enjoy from, you know, if someone said to me, oh, here's your new song, you know, dancing. All you have to do is sit in front of your phone and play your parts and make sure people can see your fingers. I'd be like, I'm not doing that. It's like, I'm just not doing that, you know? And I find that incredibly boring. So thank God we've been able to get, you know, some budgets by pulling together friends, you know, from obviously the company, and Ibanez has always been a great supporter. And putting in money ourselves just so we can pay everybody, you know, to show up at one location with the right gear and everything to do it. But it's expensive. It doesn't doesn't quite make sense in today's market to spend money on a music video, but we do it anyway because, you know, if you look at the big picture, none of what we do spending money on it makes any sense at all. Like, you know, spending money on making his instrumental rock record. I mean, I don't know how to justify that other than we love it. We think it's cool and we're just going to do it. So that's the kind of the way I look at it. It's just let's just do it because we know it's cool. And we'll let the market decide what to do with it. We have no control over that anyway. So,
yeah. How have you been, you know, you and Steve know each other so well for so long now, but if we look at like the Satch Vibe band and the record that's been taking shape as you guys have been doing shows and all that kind of thing, like how have you kind of seen the band evolve? How has it challenged you? How has Steve challenged you? How have you seen all of that kind of find its way back into the record perhaps?
Oh, without a doubt, every song that Steve would send me, I'd be, the first thing I'd say is like, oh, that's really cool. And then I go, how am I going to play any of that? You know, it's very, he figures out a way to present me with stuff that I haven't played before, you know. Sometimes I'll figure out a way of coming in sideways. But I think as we played on each other's songs, or as we would contribute to the slow building of a song together over time, that challenging each other was the key to making the album really fun to listen to top to bottom. I can give you a good example. There was a song that turned out really great called Bronco Freight Train. And it started with kind of like two or three parts that Steve had sent that didn't really define themselves as other than here's an amazing Steve Vai intro and here's an amazing Steve Vai riff and then here's this really cool little breakdown. And he said, oh, I don't know if it's a song and maybe we shouldn't do it. And I'm like, no. This is like classic Steve Vai. We're definitely doing it. Just give me a couple of days, you know. And so I wound up writing, I kind of took his riff and kind of simplified it a bit. And then I wrote a verse and a chorus. And then I expanded the breakdown, which I thought was just such a beautiful solo section, you know. And, you know, I crossed my fingers and I sent it back to him. I said, what do you think? And he's like, oh, that's great. Yeah, that's great. But what's the melody going to be? And then we were like having a three-way message chat with our producer, Eric Codia. And we were talking about like, yeah, it's like, what, how could you possibly put a melody on this thing after this gigantic Steve Vai intro, you know? So I quickly did this whammy pedal thing. And, you know, we're just, you know, recording it and then messaging it to each other. And of course, they're both of them are like, oh no, that's really great. That's really great. And like 10 minutes later, Steve sends me a counterpoint on a whammy pedal guitar to mine. So the two of them are, you know, two whammy pedal guitars are playing it. Then he took the riff and he wrote a melody on top of the main riff, which I never thought of doing. I thought the riff should stand by itself. And then eventually we decided, first time it comes, it stands by itself. Second time, it has Steve's harmonized melody on top there. And then we get to the solo section, and this is, you know, after this song has had, you know, this detuned guitar, these whammy, dueling whammy pedal things, and the heavy riffs in detuned guitars. And I thought, oh, I know what Steve's not expecting. So I took out 58 Telecaster and a slide. I did a slide solo. And of course, he was like, whoa, like, that's insane. This is like, I never thought you were going to do a slide solo on this thing. And then he came in and did you know, space age Steve Vai. So it was really great how it happened. And it you know, it took a while. It must have taken 4 or 5 months of, you know, this part and you sit with it while you're working on other songs. And then, you know, one guy comes back in town from the Beat tour or the Hagar tour and goes, okay, now I got to get back to that song, you know. But the aspect of us challenging each other with not only physically on the guitar with parts, but also the conceptually, this kind of a part could go here. And, the other guy would go, really? Let's check it out. Let's see how we can make it work. And that's been so exciting for me.
And I hadn't thought about this until Steve mentioned Eric the other day, but it's really interesting, even virtually, just to put Eric and Steve in the same room collaboratively. Like all the work you've done with Eric over the years, like that's a pretty fascinating thing to throw into the mix with a Steve Vai.
Yes. Yeah. Steve was very surprised when we started working, and Eric would do the weirdest things. I mean, just the weirdest things to our demos, and in a very playful way, he would message us to us, and he'd say, "Hey, what do you think about this?" And then, Steve would later on say to me, "Is this what he does? Is it like you send him stuff and he turns everything upside down?" And there was there was a point we were working on the song Dancing, and I don't know how he did it, but he took a part of the song, which is in a Dorian key, a minor scale type mode, and he made the whole thing in a major scale. It totally blew Steve's mind. He just didn't understand how anybody could do that so quickly to all the tracks like that. And again, he would say, "Is this the way you work with him?" And I go, Yeah, like he will challenge you like in ways you have no idea what he's going to throw at you, and then conversely, he will keep things as simple and straight ahead as possible if he thinks, as a producer, like that is the best way to do it. So he's not just always twiddling knobs and editing just because he can, it's always music first.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've talked about some freaks of nature here today, and one of the freaks of nature we are glad to have really at the peak of his powers here in 2026, you mentioned him, but Glenn Hughes. How did you guys, what was the experience of, one, getting Glenn to come and do that song with you? That had to be a pretty awesome experience, but also you and Steve are working on this song. How did Glenn kind of come to mind as, like, we should get Glenn on this?
That's a very funny story. I had started to write that song, "I Want to Play My Guitar." And like I told Steve, I'm working on this song, and it's sort of like us as kids, we're because of the whole album. My concept of the album was to go back and to reflect on our childhoods together, and because to me, that was the strongest bond that we had. And it had nothing to do with the music business. It was just love of music, the rock and roll dream as kids. So this was another one of those songs that was about that. And I'm not that great at writing lyrics, but I'd written all these lyrics, and I was thinking like the idea is that this is a rock star who's standing on stage and he's trying to communicate to the people at this mythical concert he's giving that this is what it's like to be a rock star. What he sees when he looks out to the audience but what's really in his heart. He just wants to play his guitar, So as I'm writing it, I'm doing a Monsters of Rock cruise. And the Darkness and Glenn Hughes are on the cruise. And I believe it or not, I had this thought, what if I asked both of them to sing on this song, And I thought, okay, that's a crazy idea. I have no idea like how that would work anyway, to have two amazing singers on this song. So once I calmed down and my thought process was more clear, I just asked Glenn. I said, "Look, I got this crazy song. Here's the demo." This is really embarrassing. I have my phone and I put my phone up against the computer as I played the demo file, and I very quietly sang, "I want to play my guitar to sound like a rock singer." And I said, if this ever gets out, it'd be so embarrassing, but I have to tell Glenn, I have to let him know where I'm going with this and how I think he could make this come alive. And he loved the idea, and he totally understood the point of view, you know, all around the world, rocking every night, you know, the whole idea of like, because it was really like Glenn's life in a way of being on stage and looking out at rock and roll audiences around the world. And, but we didn't know how it was going to really proceed. We finished the music piece by piece over a period of months. The only time that Steve and I were together for this whole record was when the day that we recorded Glenn's vocals at Steve's studio. It was really funny when I think about it now. And we sat down and, you know, we had my lyrics and we had, Steve had written an entirely different set of lyrics as well. A different point of view. Very interesting. His point of view is just slightly different. It's almost like someone standing in a different part of the room, you know? And so I said, okay, you know what we should do? We should just let Glenn decide, because he's the one who knows how to sing. We don't know how to sing, you know? And we're not real lyric writers. And so let's let him decide. So on that morning on the way over, he just messaged me and he said, okay, I think I'm going to sing mostly your lyrics just so you're prepared. So I said, okay. So we sat down on the couch and we just went through every line and like, I like this, I don't like that. Can I change this line to that line? Let's use Steve's bridge and Joe's chorus. And then, you know, we basically just wrote all the lyrics together by commenting on what was natural, what Glenn really wanted to sing, how he wanted to do it. Then the next few hours, and I mean like 5 hours, Glenn just sang his ass off. Like, it was amazing the amount of takes he did. Every take got better and better and better, and we just didn't want to stop recording him, because every time we go through it, he'd do something else and we go like, oh, that's it, that's the keeper, you know. It was really a lot of fun. So that there's another thing that happens, which is we get to the point where we thought there was going to be call and response vocals. And I had left by then to go do something with Sam. And a few weeks later, we realized the background answers don't work. Like had we been in a band, we could have figured that out in like 5 minutes, like, you know, in a rehearsal room, like a normal band. But it was just like an idea that we thought would work, and we didn't get to it 2 weeks later. And then we went, ooh, maybe it doesn't. And then so we thought, well, okay, Glenn's gone, you know, he's off on tour, so we can't add any more of his vocals. So we thought, well, let's just answer everything with guitars. And so that was the last thing we did, very close to mixing, which was every time Glenn sings and then Steve and I play in stereo. And that, again, we thought maybe Steve would play and then I would play. And then it just turned into we together always answer Glenn's vocals. Yeah, it's really interesting how that song came together, considering it started, you know, with me just sitting down with a guitar with this riff, you know, and imagining, you know, a mythical lead singer telling the audience what his life is like being a rock star, you know.
So. Dude, there is always a story behind every one of your songs. It's really something. Your stories are all little mini movies about these songs. All right, last few things here. Obviously, with Sammy and the Residency, thank you, Encore, good night. Like, you guys end up having a great song that ends up, you know, it's become a good part of this ongoing show. How much have you guys talked about doing other stuff, you know, musically? Because I know that, like, you know, you'd always hope to do more Chickenfoot type stuff with Sammy. Like, obviously, this is not Chickenfoot, but it's like you've opened a door. You guys did a song. Like, so I just wondered, like, how much have you guys talked about, like, doing other music?
It comes up now and then. I mean, I'm always writing stuff anyway, and I'll throw ideas to Sam. But, you know, I think Sam's in a really unique position right now, where he's got this fantastic catalog, you know, that is a testament to, you know, his creativity, with playing with different bands and being a solo artist. And I think in some ways I get the feeling he's thinking, I think this is it. Like, I don't want to keep working on albums and just pushing them out because that's what I did before. And, you know, as funny as it was how the thank you song came together, it seems like it's a great sort of cap to his career as a writer, you know? So I haven't, you know, like every time it's come up, people ask us that all the time. I don't get the feeling that he's dying to get back into the studio and do that again. I mean, he's been doing that since he was like a teenager, you know, and he's 78. And I think he wants to enjoy performing the catalog that he's built over the years rather than, you know, keep working for the man, so to speak, you know?
So kind of related to that, I also wondered, like, when it comes to this Satch Vi stuff, do you still, being Joe Satriani, always have kind of like the next Satriani record taking shape in your head? How has like that kind of affected your normal flow of things that you're working on? Because I know, you know, you mentioned as we were getting going, like you got these paintings going on. Joe Satriani always seems to have like 12 things going on at any given time. So I know you've got 11 other things going on. We'll take out the paintings and the Satch Vi, so 10 other things. But I'm just, that was something else I thought of, was just wondering like how the idea of what you're doing with Steve kind of affects and or potentially influences something else you might have taking shape in your mind as far as, you know, just a regular kind of joke kind of record.
I think in many ways, you know, Steve and I are similar in that when we're working on one thing, it inspires us to imagine something completely opposite. You know, Steve's talked a lot about, he's been working on an acoustic album, vocal album, you know, for a while. And that's the complete opposite of everything that he's, you know, been putting out in the last couple of years. And I certainly have entertained the idea of trying to strip down my production ideas quite a bit. I think that, I mean, I was starting to go down that road, I think, with shape-shifting and what happens next. But during a period of the pandemic where a lot of people were working remotely, you know, sort of lended itself towards, you know, not being recorded live in a room because people couldn't be together as much as we wanted to be. So people started layering a lot more because they were working remotely. They'd be by themselves in the studio and they'd say, oh, okay, keyboards, organ, strings, synthesizer, you know, tambourine, acoustic, banjo, you know. So I started to think like, okay, after the Elephants of Mars, I had such a intense time making that record. I thought, next time I go out, I think I want to do something really stripped down, you know, power trio or something like that. You know, this, I think the work with Sammy and Mike sort of intervened, and then this work with Steve kind of intervened. So now I'm not really sure where I would go next, but I have a lot of songs written that could go in either direction, where there's a lot of production or there's very little production. I don't know where I'm leaning yet.
Ah, I love that. Well, here's the final thing. That is, you mentioned G3. When is the world going to get to see the G3 documentary that we've heard about?
that film, wow, did that take on epic proportions. So much happens from the beginning of, you know, ZZ's idea to document that to what we wound up actually filming, and what I think ZZ discovered, you know, emotionally along the way about the entire story. And I think as it stands now, it's two films. It's the documentary that really is about ZZ himself and having one of the strangest dads you could imagine. And the other is just a standalone G3 reunion tour documentary because he shot so much footage. You know, he was with us on tour for those 3 weeks. But like it's very, you know, his schedule is very much in a way like mine and Steve's, is that he's also working independently for other people, and that keeps getting in the way of the solo project, as it were, you know. But he's really close to getting into just pure editing stage of the main documentary. So that's where he's at right now. So yeah, we're looking forward to that coming out soon.
That's cool, man. Well, Joe, it's always cool to talk music, and I'll let you get back to painting and everything else. But thanks always for taking the
Yeah.
time, man. It's always a real pleasure.
Great to talk to you. Have a good one.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.